You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our micro learning podcast series, Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in Retinal Disease to Lower Burden and Improve Outcomes. I'm your host, Sharon Windsor Harker, Medical Director of the Vision Relief Program at Med Learning Group. This is a five-part podcast addressing treatment burden in retinal disease, and today we're focusing on retinal vein occlusion. Joining us today is Dr. Vas Sada, Director of Artificial Intelligence and Imaging Research at the Doheny Eye Institute and Professor of Ophthalmology at the UCLA Geffen School of Medicine in Pasadena. Let's get started with today's episode. Hello, Dr. Sada. We're so pleased to welcome you to our podcast.
Thanks very much, Sharon. It's great to be here with you. Look forward to this.
Fantastic. Dr. Sada, do you think that we truly understand the pathophysiology of retinal vein occlusion?
Sharon, that's a great question, and I would say our understanding is incomplete. Of course, there are some situations where patients can have specific diseases that can cause their blood to be what we call a hypercoagulable state, and that can lead to vein occlusions, you know, for example, if they develop leukemia or problems of that sort. But when we think about the typical retinal vein occlusion, it's usually in a patient who doesn't have those kinds of issues. But we have some understanding of what's going on because we understand some of the risk factors for vein occlusion, which include things like glaucoma, but also hypertension. I would also say that the pathophysiology probably varies a bit depending on whether it's a branch retinal vein occlusion versus a central retinal vein occlusion. In both cases, though, we do believe that there is arteriosclerosis and compression of the vein by the artery. And that's why hypertension could potentially be a factor because there's thickening of the arterial wall. But that compression, we think, ultimately leads to the occlusion of the vein. And in the case of central retinal vein occlusion, there's probably some component of a congenital sort of component, if you will, in terms of the actual anatomy and how the vein and artery are configured as they approach the eye.
Treatment for RVO has evolved significantly over the years. Can you walk us through how treatment approaches have changed?
Yeah, so I have to say, you know, since I've been in clinical practice now for about 25 years, I really have seen quite an evolution. In the old days, when I first trained, before we entered the era of anti-VEGF therapy, our primary treatment was laser. And so, for example, if patients develop neovascularization as a complication of RVO, and we would consider scatter panretinal photocoagulation. I would add that if they develop neovascularization, even now, that's the treatment that we'd use. But the more common problem for these patients is the development of macular edema associated with the blockage. And that's where the treatment has really changed. You know, in the old days, before we had anti-VEGF therapy, laser didn't really seem to work so well for central retinal vein occlusion associated with macular edema, unless the patient was a young patient under 60, in which case there was maybe some suggestion it could help. But for older patients with RVO, for CRVO, we had no treatment. And for branch retinal vein occlusion, we just had laser. And so that's how it was until we entered the anti-VEGF therapy era and then the development of steroids. And then really with first-generation anti-VEGF agents such as ranibizumab or bevacizumab, which would be off-label, but of course aflibercept, 2 milligrams, we for the first time had treatments that could really impact the disease course for patients with macular edema associated with both central retinal and branch retinal vein occlusion. And I would also add that we have, of course, steroid therapies that were shown to be beneficial, such as triamcinolone as well as dexamethasone. And that's really, I think, transformed the outlook for patients. And now, of course, in the last few years, we've entered the era of second generation agents, which offer the prospects of greater durability because they may either feature a higher dose or they may target more potential targets beyond VEGF.
What do you love about creating this condition?
Well, I have to tell you, I did love it before when I first was training because I didn't feel like we had great options for patients. But what I love about it now is that we actually have an opportunity to improve vision for patients. And that's very satisfying to be able to offer something to help patients with their vision. And I very much look at these therapies as trying to prevent any permanent visual deterioration, but also improving the vision in the hopes that you kind of keep things stable until hopefully the body has an opportunity to try to reroute the circulation, you know, through collaterals or some other mechanism. And so just the concept of improving vision for patients, I think, has been a huge boon.
Well, I'm sure you make a huge difference to your patients. Let's talk challenges. What are the biggest hurdles you face in managing RVO?
Well, I'd say the biggest problem relates, I think, to patient compliance and durability of treatment. You know, I mentioned, you know, hypertension is a risk factor for vein occlusions. Diabetes can also be a risk factor. So the point is that these patients may have other systemic health issues. They have other doctor's appointments to go to, transportation could be a problem. And so we have a problem with patients adhering to treatment. They miss doses, and then, you know, they can develop recurrent significant edema. And sometimes there's consequences to this type of recurrence of edema. There can be permanent loss of photoreceptors that ultimately can impair the best outcomes for patients. And so I think that is probably the biggest barrier. Also, I think that there also are some hurdles with regards to just a general awareness in the public of the next generation of treatments, of the fact that there are options potentially to prolong treatment intervals. And so I think those are things that we could do better.
You mentioned adherence being a challenge. What do you think the biggest barriers are for patients who are having challenges with adherence?
The biggest part is related to getting into the office because, as I said, you know, these patients can have other comorbid medical conditions that they have to go to other doctor's appointments or they get hospitalized. Or, you know, the other thing is they're coming from a long ways and they, you know, transport is a big problem. Oftentimes, you know, they're elderly, they don't feel comfortable driving, they have to get a family member to take time off. It's a big problem not having treatments that are durable.
How do clinicians best address these barriers?
Well, I think that the one thing is that people, you know, for all of myself and all of my colleagues, you know, going to meetings, attending programs like this or others where you can actually get exposed to the latest data, I think is pretty important because that way you can offer the full sort of spectrum of options to your patients, but also understand how you might approach to using them. And also, I think if you're able to participate in programs with colleagues, you're able to potentially have discussions and share knowledge about what might be the best way to approach treatment of patients. But as I said, these next generation anti-VEGF therapies, in particular, I would highlight the faricimab, but also 8 milligram of aflibercept. These really, I think, have shown in studies that they can be dosed with a lower frequency, with most patients going out to 12 weeks or longer dosing, and still maintain good visual gains and a dry retina, which is pretty remarkable and I think makes these treatments more practical for patients.
Which studies have you found to be of interest lately?
Well, I do think that we have new studies for retinal vein occlusion with these next generation therapies. We, of course, for faricimab, they did 2 separate trials, one for branch retinal vein occlusion, which is the Balaton study, and one for central retinal vein occlusion, which would be the Camino study. Both of the studies had a fairly similar design, though. And by that, I mean that patients had an initial loading sort of dosage of 6 monthly injections. And the way the studies were done, they were randomized to receive 6 monthly faricimab versus 6 monthly aflibercept. And then they assessed the outcome. That was the outcome for approval. And they showed, of course, that you could get good improvement of vision and drying of the retina with actually a greater reduction in leakage in patients treated with faricimab. But then what was really interesting about those trials, and this is where I think that I find them to be of great clinical interest, is that patients were then put into a treat and extend arm, which is really what reflects what we do in practice. So for the next year, they underwent a treat and extend therapy, and that was patients who may have been on aflibercept or faricimab to begin with. They all went on treat and extend faricimab. And that's where even with treat and extend, we saw excellent maintenance of vision with the maintenance of a dry retina, with again, more than half of the patients achieving 12-week or longer dosing interval. In fact, there's a substantial proportion, 40 to 50%, who were going every 16 weeks, which was pretty important information, I think. And then, of course, we have the QUASAR study, which was a pivotal trial looking at aflibercept 8 milligram. That trial was designed to evaluate also against 2 milligram of aflibercept, but used either aflibercept 8 milligrams given every month for 3 months or every month for 5 months, then followed by every 8 week dosing. So the study itself wasn't designed to look for longer dosing intervals, but it's important to note that most patients were able to maintain, in fact, nearly all of them, over 80% were able to maintain 8 week dosing during the course of the study. And then after 36 weeks, they could potentially go longer. And actually, about 70% of them look like they could go to every 12 weeks using the retreatment criteria that the study had devised. So the bottom line is that by quadrupling the dose there, they're actually able to see what appeared to be greater durability. And so to me, that really highlights that we really should be using, in my viewpoint, I'm going to get the best outcomes for patients, these next generation agents.
Personalizing care is so critical in ophthalmology. How do you tailor your treatment strategies to meet the unique needs of each patient?
So I think, you know, I highlighted how, for example, in the first MAB trials, they used a treat and extend approach. And that really reflects, I think, what most of us do in clinical practice, that we try to maintain a dry retina, but we try to reduce the inconvenience for patients of coming in for frequent visits. So we, you know, we try to extend the interval between visits if the retina is dry after an injection when the patient comes back. So I think that's a great personalization because we do know in the trials there was a distribution, right? There were a few patients who still needed to have every month therapy and, you know, through the first year. And there was others who could go to every 16 weeks or longer. And so you really want to tailor your approach to the specific treatment needs of that individual patient. And that's where OCT, looking for the presence of fluid, is really a critical tool in this type of personalization.
What clinical pearls do you have for those treating patients with RVO?
Well, I would say that that one of the things is, you know, as I said, I think that you need to get the patient to maintain compliance with therapy to get the best outcomes. And because of that, I would consider getting to second generation therapies quickly, because I just don't think that more than every 12-week dosing is practical for many patients. If there's a patient that I'm not going to be able to get quickly to every 12 weeks, I'll want to have them on a second generation therapy. I want to argue right away to request authorization for that. And I think it's very reasonable to start with a second generation therapy for patients, because why not give them the best possible outcome? And of course, you know, part of what we do is limited by what insurance will allow and the like. One pearl I would give is that maybe, you know, look at how the patient's responding after the first one or two injections. Even after the first injection, patients who seem to show a relatively slow or minor response, those are patients who probably aren't going to do well with that first generation therapeutic, and somebody you might be considering early on to go to second generation anti-VEGF or steroid therapy, because you know, you don't want to let them stay swollen and then irreversibly lose vision. So I would just say get the retina dry as fast as possible and keep it dry to get the best outcome for the patients. That would be the single best pearl that I can give.
As the director of AI and imaging research at your facility, you're at the forefront of innovation. How do you see AI and advanced imaging impacting the future of RVO management?
Well, I think there are several potential ways. I mean, AI is a bit challenging because one of the barriers, I think, for AI to get into our clinical practices already is that, you know, you have to get these tools to be FDA cleared, in which case then somebody has to do, who's bringing the AI algorithm out there, they have to do the study to satisfy the FDA and get it approved, and that costs money, and then who's going to pay for it to make it make a business sense. So there are some practical problems in getting things out there. But I think where we can see, as those problems are tackled, where we can see a potential benefit, I see two potential applications. The immediate one, which is kind of, it's already ready to go. It's just simply a matter of getting something FDA approved so we can use it. It's just something to more accurately quantify the fluid. For example, so we can track how the patient is responding, decide, oh, did they have a good response or not? Yes, we visualize that, we do a good job just eyeballing it, but having that quantitative result could be quite helpful. Similarly, if you quantify fluid, we already know that we have HOMO-CT, FDA cleared, that has an algorithm associated with it. It's intended for neovascular AMD, but one can imagine that you can use a similar approach for RVO and then have the patient home monitor with HOMO-CT and come in when the AI identifies that fluid is recurred. So those would be some applications. But I think the really exciting application for the future is that we can use an AI model to predict how a patient's going to do. So we can say, oh, you know, I ran your images through the AI and your other information, and it says that you should get your vision back to at least 20/40 with an X percent chance or what have you. Or we can say, well, I'm really sorry to tell you this, Mrs. Smith, but it doesn't look too good in terms of how much vision we get back, but we're going to do the best we can. And, you know, how we counsel the patient could be modified based on that. But also you can imagine that AI might tell us, okay, this is a patient that, you know, they're just not going to respond to first generation therapy. They need to have a second generation therapeutic immediately to get the best outcome. So you can imagine those types of things potentially affecting how we manage patients in the future if we can get AI algorithms approved.
Dr. Sada, this has been such an insightful conversation. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise. Before we wrap up, could you share why this topic is so important to you personally?
Well, you know, for those of us who go into ophthalmology and retina, go into it because we're trying to help patients with their vision. It's incredibly satisfying. I have to say that when I went into medical retina, it wasn't that popular because, as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, we didn't really have great treatments, not just for RVO, but even for neovascular AMD. And for me, it's been so amazingly gratifying to see how treatments have evolved over the last 2.5 decades and how we can actually help patients. And so I think participating in programs like this, I'm really very happy to do it because I think that, you know, disseminating information, knowledge to our whole community so we can all do the best for our patients. There's really nothing better that we can do.
Thank you again, Dr. Sada, for an engaging and informative discussion.
Thanks very much, Cheryl. It really was great to be here with you.
Thank you again. To our listeners, we hope you found this episode valuable as you navigate the evolving landscape of retinal disease management. Please join us again soon for our next episode in this series, where we'll explore neovascular age-related macular degeneration with Dr. Priya Vakharia. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. A special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Inc., who provided an independent educational grant for this activity.